From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, nuclear option in the Senate, U.S. troops and Afghanistan, Iran talks, family feud, and the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Senate Democrats, frustrated by Republican stonewalling on presidential nominees, take the nuclear option, saying no to the filibuster there. Majority Leader, Senator Harry Reid.
For the good of the United States of America, it's time to change. It's time to change the Senate before this institution becomes obsolete.
Former Vice President Dick Cheney's daughters feuded publicly over gay marriage. Liz Cheney, running for Senate in Wyoming, said she opposes it. Mary Cheney, lesbian and married, pushed back. Here's Liz.
I love Mary very much. I love her family very much. This is just an issue on which we disagree.
And today, the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination. Here's the first report that the president was shot in Dallas from CBS's Walter Cronkite.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable with William McKenzie of the Dallas Morning News, Trudy Rubin of the Philadelphia Inquirer, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Did the Senate need to change? Will we stay in Afghanistan? And what are you thinking on the Cheney sisters, cocaine, and the congressman, the anniversary of the death of JFK? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Dallas is Pulitzer Prize winner Bill McKenzie. He went to the same high school as Lee Harvey Oswald, different years. Editorial columnist for the Dallas Morning News. Bill McKenzie, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
And from Philadelphia, Trudy Rubin joins us, foreign affairs columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Trudy, welcome back to you as well.
Nice to be here, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Bill, and Trudy.
Let's go straight to the nuclear option in the Senate. We've got a lot to look at this week, but Republicans came back swinging hard as the Democrats changed the rules. Yesterday, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, here he is.
If you want to play games, set yet another precedent that you'll no doubt come to regret. Say to my friends on the other side of the aisle, you'll regret this, and you may regret it a lot sooner than you think.
You will regret this, say Republicans. President Obama said had to be done.
In each of these cases, it's not been because they opposed the person, that there was some assessment that they were unqualified, that there was some scandal that had been unearthed. It was simply because they opposed the policies that the American people voted for in the last election.
Lots of analysts now saying partisan divisions likely to become worse. Senator John McCain yesterday, Republican of Arizona, said that the change, the nuclear option, casts a chill on the Senate.
Now there are no rules in the United States Senate because by a simple majority, they're changing the rules of the Senate. Therefore, now there are no rules in the Senate. They can change any procedure that they want to. That is a devastating effect, and it will change the way that this institution functions.
Bill McKenzie, you're watching all this from Dallas. Of course, it's just about presidential nominees. It's not about Supreme Court nominees. Party line vote, Democrats saying you can't hold up so many historic numbers held up under President Obama. It just won't, Senate won't work. The government won't work if this is how we proceed. But you hear the Republicans pushing back hard. What do you think of the Democrats' justification or lack thereof here, Bill, and what's coming now?
Well, you know what I think this is? I think this debate over the filibuster is really only the symptom. The larger disease is we have a politics where people just loathe each other. And that's the great mystery that I don't have an answer for. But I think this filibuster debate is a continuum. You know, we've seen the same kind of deep divisions over issues as recently as the budget debates. And they just continue. We see it over immigration. And I, you know, certainly there's some substantive issues involved. But we just have these deep divisions. I look at my own state here in Texas. We once had fairly bipartisan politics. So, you know, we're at each other's throats. And I'm at a loss to know what's going to get us past this. So I think my answer on the filibuster, I'm sorry it's happening. Yes, it's going to worsen the situation. I agree with McCain. It's going to get worse before it gets better. But I think it's only the symptom. The disease is we have a politics where really folks really loathe each other.
Trudy, rough politics, we all know that, deeply divided. But here's a specific procedural rules change after a long period of waiting on a lot of nominees that were not moving. Do you see the Democrats as justified here or not, Trudy, and justified or not? Are they wise with this change?
You know, this reminds me of Claude Rains in Casablanca. Mm-hmm. I'm shocked, mm-hmm. and horrified. It was a joke. He was being cynical. This does not destroy the rules in the Senate, and it doesn't plunge the chamber into new and uncharted territories. When the Republic was founded, the filibuster didn't exist. And before the 1970s, filibusters were rare. Filibusters have exploded recently and become the norm, but requiring 60 votes for everything was not what the founders had in mind. So I think this was inevitable. I mean, you could see that the Democrats didn't want to do it because they know if the Republicans take the Senate, it will be used against mm-hmm. them and they won't be able to hold up Republican bills or Republican nominees. On the other hand, everything was frozen, and I think it had become so clear that the Democrats were not going to be able to get any legislation passed, even immigration, which a lot of Republicans had professed to want, immigration reform, because of partisan blockage. So for the time being, there was nothing to lose, and at least they can get executive appointments and judicial appointments through. I mean, three appeals court justices, you couldn't get anything approved. So I think Democrats were actually pushed to the wall. They didn't really want to do it, but maybe this is the way the Senate has to go with this kind of partisanship. The party that wins the most seats has to be able to do something.
Jack, what do you think? Who's outsmarted whom here? Republicans, holding the line so hard that the Democrats, as Trudy says, thought, well, we have nothing to lose, nothing passing anyway.
Right.
On the other hand, turnabout's fair play. There will sooner or later be a change in the majority, and Democrats will be looking at this. What about that, Jack, and the saucer that's supposed to cool the tea here, the U.S. Senate?
Well, it sort of boiled over this week. I'm struck by the arguments. The Democrats saying this is democracy, this is majority rule, and the Republicans rightly are saying, no, this is the tyranny of the majority. And the question is, what are the consequences? You know, a nuclear option has fallout. What's the fallout? Some people are saying, I saw a Senate parliamentarian saying that, you know, the Senate doesn't operate really according to rules so much as precedents. A precedent has been set now on executive appointments. Will that precedent that the filibuster will be disallowed, will that now be ratcheted up to apply to legislation? And what would the implications of that be? Well, the Democrats certainly could pass their gun control bill with 90% public approval. On the other hand, Grover Norquist could come along with a bill that said needs 2/3 vote of the Senate to raise taxes, and that could pass.
But is anybody even talking about that right now, Jack? Is
no.
that on the table anywhere?
No, but that's the kind of thing the parliamentarian was saying. This is the kind of thing that creeps on from a precedent. And inevitably, with the worsening of partisan acrimony, that possibility, I think, will come up. In the shorter term, these younger Democratic senators are talking about something else, which is reinstituting the talking filibuster, making senators come down and actually play Jimmy Stewart if they want to tie
Everett
up the
Dirksen
government.
Style,
yes,
if you want
right.
to do it.
Yeah.
Bill McKenzie, did the Republicans overplay their hand here? Did Democrats overplay their hand?
Well, I don't think we're going to know the answer for a while until how this plays mm-hmm. out. I'm going to go back to my other argument here a moment, though. I think we're arguing about mechanics, and I think we're missing the larger point. And the larger point is this is just one more chapter in this politics of division, whether it's the filibuster, it's the debt or something else. And the question is, how do we find some sort of create a civic culture where people can, you know, they can argue, but they just aren't going to be loathing each other the way we have. So that's my main thought.
Sorry, Trudy. I mean, who couldn't agree? And yet the mechanics matter as we, you know, grope our way in the dark of division here.
You know, if to me, looking honestly at what has happened to politics here, and I travel a lot around the world, so it's very painful to see U.S. democracy look as thwarted and as stymied as would-be democracies in many developing countries. Yeah. We used to be a model. But what I see in this case, I do think the Republican Party has been more partisan, driven by a minority within it, and doesn't look like that's going to change anytime soon. So one has to look, I think, at the question of how do you make government work? Say the parties are going to loathe each other. How do you create a system where you can get something done? And I find it astonishing that we're talking about tyranny of the majority. We have a system here where minorities are protected. They talked about tyranny of the majority under the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. This is not that system. We're not throwing minorities in jail. They can win an election the next time. So the idea that a majority could vote for something and get it through, I find not so evil, not so astonishing.
On the other hand, a lot of Democrats over the years, Barack Obama among them, Joe Biden among them, looking back to him, Joe Biden, then senator in 2005, talking about exactly this move, saying the nuclear option abandons America's sense of fair play, tilting the playing field on the side of those who control and own the field. He said then, I say to my friends on the Republican side, you may own the field right now, but you won't own it forever. That's the Democratic then-senator, now vice president speaking, Jack.
Turnabout is fair play. You know, he famously in the 32 campaign, President Roosevelt promised Pittsburgh to balance the budget. And later on, he said it never was in Pittsburgh. Joe Biden never said that.
Well, of course, he did. On the other hand, we'll get some nominees confirmed, I guess, now, and we'll see how the government actually works with people in place. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're looking at a week in the news this hour, nuclear option in the U.S. Senate, a U.S. troop deal, maybe, in Afghanistan, gay marriage and the Cheney sisters. The nation remembers JFK. We will as well before this hour is out. A mind also this week on the terrible destruction in the Midwest by that huge line of tornadoes there. Bill McKenzie joins us today from Dallas, Texas, where, of course, the terrible assassination occurred 50 years ago today. Editorial columnist there, columnist for the Dallas Morning News. And Trudy Rubin joins us, foreign affairs columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. Let's go to our listeners, Joe in Columbia, South Carolina. Joe, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mr. McConnell, you played a
clip. He's saying Democrats are playing games here, but you wait.
Right. Yeah, we're talking about playing games. The Republicans have been playing games for years up under Obama, blocking just about every nominee that Mr. Obama puts up there. What is he talking about?
Well, I mean,
they started playing the games themselves.
Yeah, Joe, we've got it, Jack. When the Democrats put up the chart of how many nominees have been blocked and how different it looks from, I mean, it's always happened some, but how much higher the number is this time, it does look like we're been pushed into new territory, Jack.
Yes, according to Harry Reid, half of all the filibusters waged against nominations in Senate history have occurred since President Obama was elected, and 20 of his district court nominees were filibustered. Before that, in our whole history, only 3 such filibusters took place. So the numbers argue Joe's case overwhelmingly. Now, Republicans reply, wait a minute. Have we really prevented a cabinet official from being appointed? No, we haven't done that. Have we stopped a Supreme Court nom? No, we haven't done that. And then they shift the argument slightly. They say, all right, well, we have been particularly obstreperous about these 3 appointees to the District Court of Appeals in Washington. Mm-hmm. But that Court of Appeals, they don't do anything there. Their workload is ridiculous. Light. They don't need 3 more judges. Well, the trouble with that argument is there's some quantity, some data that backs it up. But the trouble is the cases they get are very important, and they involve crucially people suing the federal government, as, for example, power plant owners are almost sure to.
And of course, there's been a path right there to the U.S. Supreme Court as well.
Yes, that's right.
Let me get arguments on both sides. Christopher in New Haven, Connecticut. Christopher, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm actually a professor of politics at George Washington University, but calling from New Haven. I wanted to make two quick points. The first being that I think what hasn't been stressed enough on this program is that the use of this nuclear option sets a precedent so that you could use it against Supreme Court. You could invoke the nuclear option against legislation. So we really have, in fact, lost a protection of minority rights.
Though they are explicitly saying that this does not apply to either of those now.
Yes, but the precedent is set that you can change the rules by a vote of 51 votes. So they might do it in another instance. The other point I wanted to address is a couple of minutes ago, you were talking about the partisanship and how do we get out of this.
Yes, please.
And I really think we've been through periods like this in our history, and the only way we'll get out of it is when the public clearly decides that it wants the country to move in one direction or another direction, and then we wind up with a more or less permanent majority and a more or less permanent minority.
But how do we get there this time, Professor? We've got a 9%, is it, or 8% approval rating of Congress? But I don't see that open that light that we can fly toward where we get to a majority on either side. We seem perpetually deadlocked here.
We do seem deadlocked. I think we can see it possibly coming over the big fight over Obamacare, which now seems to have some wind in the Republican sails. But I think that it is fundamentally an issue of how we want the government to relate to the rest of society. And that's clearly the biggest divide between the Republicans and the Democrats. So I think we're going to fight the 2014 election on that issue. I'm not sure yet who will win. Clearly, the disastrous rollout has been a problem for Obama. But as you know, the Democrats keep saying once people see it, they'll discover that they like it. So,
and of course, look back at what we had. It's not like that was such a rosy path on health care either for millions and millions of Americans. Christopher, thank you for calling. Trudy.
Yes, I just would like to bring up a historical point. The conversation goes as if the filibuster was written into the Constitution. It wasn't. At the founding of the Republic, it didn't exist. Prior to the 1970s, it was incredibly rare. The filibuster is a product of partisanship. It is not a constitutional guarantee of minority rights. There are plenty of guarantees, the biggest one being that the minority in the Senate 1 year can be the majority 2 years hence. So the whole argument about protection of minority rights is actually a hollow and ahistorical argument. And when Republicans hark back to the Constitution, that doesn't fly. And what the gentleman from New Haven just said about having strict party lines be the solution. In fact, the way things used to get done was when there was a center and people crossed party lines and you had coalitions. That's when government worked. How we get back to that, I don't know. But the filibuster is a product of partisanship. It is not a guarantor of minority rights.
Bill McKenzie, do you see a way out of this deadlock one way or another?
At the moment, no, I don't. I think, though, that the professor had a good point. I think it's really up to those of us, you know, us voters to want to have some clear preferences. And I agree with Trudy. I think if we, once we get to that point where we'll see more people who will be in the center, and they could be center right, they could be center left, but they're there because they want to get things done. They don't want to just sit there and fly on planes back and forth to Washington to claw the other person's eyes out. I will say one thing, to speak up for McConnell here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you recall when Jim Wright was Speaker, my fellow Fort Worth resident, and he was the Democratic Speaker. There was I don't remember the rule change he made, but he made some changes there in the late 80s that really angered a lot of moderate Republicans. And they went over and sided with Newt Gingrich, who I believe at the time was running for minority whip,
okay.
I think was the post. And that kind of gave rise to Gingrich, you know, because they were so frustrated with the way Wright was running the chamber. I was living in D.C. at the time and working with a lot of moderate Republicans. And so they gave birth to Gingrich. So perhaps what McConnell's saying is, you know, if you press us this hard, you don't know what's going to be coming next. And I also will say, it wasn't just McConnell saying that. Carl Levin, I believe, a Michigan Democrat, was saying the same thing. I think he was one of three Democrats to vote against this.
Of course, you can just ask, you know, anybody on either side who's the more extreme, and extreme feeds on extreme, and off we go. We'll be watching that one. I want to turn abroad for a second here because it involves a lot of American troops, potentially for a long time. Afghanistan, lots of talk about a deal there this week that would keep maybe 8, 10,000, 12,000 troops in Afghanistan for another decade. Unclear exactly how it's going to turn out. On Wednesday, Secretary of State John Kerry was saying in Washington that there was an agreement coming together.
I'm pleased to say that in a series of conversations with President Karzai in the course of this morning, even interrupting some of our conversations, we reached an agreement as to the final language of the bilateral security agreement that will be placed before the Loya Jirga tomorrow.
Well, maybe. Afghan President Hamid Karzai, before that Grand Assembly, Loya Jirga, hinting maybe, maybe not on a timetable the U.S. likes, and certainly not in a relationship, he said explicitly to his fellow Afghans, of trust.
My trust with America is not good. I don't trust them and they don't trust me. The last 10 years have shown that I have fought with them and they have made propaganda against me.
And then do we have a deal and for how long? The first reporting was 10 years, but here's John Kerry again talking with Andrea Mitchell of NBC News saying, no, not years and years.
Let me push back very clearly.
Please.
We are not talking about years and years. That is not what is contemplated.
That's certainly what the Afghans say. The NSC today confirmed the letter from the president.
That is not what is contemplated years and years. It is way shorter than any kind of years and years.
Trudy Rubin, what do we know about what has been even provisionally agreed on U.S. troops in Afghanistan going forward?
Well, what is depressing is that the ground keeps shifting on both sides. Karzai is clearly playing his usual game. He's being Karzai. And so he's trying to hold out for more concessions by dragging out the issue of when he will sign a deal. His people have been leaking things that are not in the deal. His people leaked the idea that there would be a serious presidential apology for past mistakes issued by President Obama. If you read the letter that the president signed, it says that U.S. troops would be exceedingly careful to avoid X, Y, and Z, but there is not a huge apology in that letter. So there is jockeying going on here. But the bottom line is, if there is not a remaining troop presence left behind to train Afghans and to sort of give their security force a little backbone while it develops further, there will also be no money. Because if all troops pull out, it is likely that Congress will not provide the funds to keep the Afghan security forces going. The Europeans will also cut back on promised funds. And if you look at history, when the Soviet imposed government of Najibullah, when the Soviets left, that government lasted for 3 years, so long as the Soviets backed it up with funds. But when Boris Yeltsin came in, he cut off the money, and that's when the Afghan government fell apart, and ultimately, after a civil war, the Taliban came in. So it's an unpleasant decision that the U.S. has to make, whether to continue to squeeze Karzai, because unless this is signed soon, it's not going to be signed at all, I believe, or whether to let the whole thing go. And then you're likely to wind up with an Afghanistan where there will be a civil war, where the Taliban will come back, and where you have a huge instability next door in nuclear-armed Pakistan. And then I think you're going to get a mess that is worse than what was there before we came in the beginning after the Taliban hosted Osama bin Laden.
Bill McKenzie, what about the U.S. side of this equation? How many troops for how many years does it feel to you that Americans are ready to support in Afghanistan?
Well, I think the number is, 8 to 12,000 that we're talking about. And I would, let's go back to what we had in Germany for a long time in Western Europe, years after the war. I think the treaty raises an important point that if our troops aren't there, Afghanistan is going to lose a lot of international money. And I think a compelling reason for some kind of presence, U.S. presence there, is, what's going to happen to Afghan women if we're going to pull out altogether? And what happens if the Taliban which is continuing to reassert itself. What happens if it gets out of our hand? What are going to happen to the rights of women, which, you know, after 9/11, we all became aware of in a much grander scale?
Yeah, no, it could be terrible. On the other hand, Jack, we've been there a long time already with a lot more than 10 or 12,000 troops, and it's not solved. We had Stephen Biddle, who used to be at the U.S. War College, on with us recently saying, you know what, even if we get the agreement to stay on, Congress is going to start not wanting to shell out that tens of billions per year. And, just do it now, he said. What do you see unfolding here, Jack?
Well, you know, I see that 22 combat deaths, 2,200 combat deaths in Afghanistan through our years and hundreds of billions of dollars. And now we have President Karzai saying, quote, we want the Americans to respect our sovereignty and laws and be an honest partner and, quote, bring a lot of money. Well, there it is, isn't it? I mean, sustain us, bribe us. Let me and my successor, presumably, continue the corruption that has become, I think Afghanistan is rated the one or two most corrupt nation in the world.
But how about a Taliban-dominated Afghanistan again, next door to Pakistan, as Trudy says?
Well, you know, that is what I think you could call a pernicious abstraction. We don't know whether that will happen. And even if it did happen, in the age of drones and everything else, it seems to me we can look after our own security adequately from the air. The idea that the Taliban were running, you know, terrorist training camps, and that's where 9/11 came from. 9/11 came out of Hamburg, came out of, you know, Cairo, came out of Riyadh. I mean, it didn't come out of there.
Well,
and
no. Yes
and chasing this phantom of security, we have essentially intervened in a Pashtun civil war that keeps going. I saw General McCaffrey the other day make the point. He says, you know, the problem with this Afghan army isn't that it doesn't have training. It's that it doesn't have a will to fight. And it doesn't because the country is divided on ethnic tribal lines.
Well, here we are a dozen years after going in, and the U.S. waits on a Loya Jirga in Afghanistan, perhaps, to see where we go. Charlie in Charleston, South Carolina. Charlie, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I was calling in regards to the congressman that recently pled guilty for the cocaine possession. And I think he just actually missed a great opportunity to raise up the issues of the American drug policy and, you know, the failure of the war on drugs as I see it. I personally think that we should actually increase legalization for more drugs, not just marijuana as we're seeing. And I'm curious to see if the panel thinks that we would ever see a congressman take a situation like that and kind of turn it as an opportunity for some change on the national level.
Yeah, well, not this time out. I mean, this was Tea Party favorite Republican Trey Raydell, freshman congressman, pleading guilty to possession of cocaine, saying he's going to go into intense rehab and all the rest. Here he is announcing on Wednesday that he'd take a leave of absence from Congress.
I will be taking a leave of absence. During that time, I'm going to donate my salary to a charity. I believe in faith. I believe in forgiveness and redemption.
Bill McKenzie, everybody believes in forgiveness and redemption when they're in trouble. He's in trouble now.
He is in trouble. And, you know, of course, it's tragic and too bad when that does happen. But I agree with you. I don't think this case is going to lead to a debate about larger drug laws.
Does it? I don't know. What does it lead to? Some contemplation within the Tea Party about who they're throwing their weight behind. I mean, it can. You know, things can show up anyway. They certainly show anywhere. They certainly showed up in Toronto with Mayor Rob Ford. But
yeah.
It's not what you expect in the language of the Tea Party. Although maybe there's a libertarian thing. Hey, bring it on.
Well, yeah, I see this as more of a personal case than a Tea Party thing. I'm not rushing the Tea Party's defense. I mean, Tea Party has been as much, has a strain of libertarianism, and it has an economic focus, kind of later became more social. I think this is just more of a personal case of a guy who had a bad problem, and it rose to the surface, and he happened to be in the Tea Party.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. In other news this week, a fierce line of tornadoes plowed through central Illinois, leaving wide destruction on Sunday. The terrifying twisters pushed two TV newscasters for WEEK-TV, Chuck Collins and Sandy Gallant, right off the air.
I am hearing things right now, Chuck.
Yes.
I think we may need to take shelter right
yes.
now ourselves.
We do.
We need to go off
we do.
The air.
Yeah.
We will be back when we can.
Right. We'll be right back.
And off they went. You do not see that every day. George Zimmerman back in the news. His girlfriend called 911 in Seminole County, Florida on Monday, saying Zimmerman had pointed a gun at her. Then Zimmerman called 911 with his own story.
I just want everyone to know the truth.
Okay. The officers can speak with you on scene. Have you already spoken with them?
No, but they're pretty upset, I think.
And President Obama, who has reportedly told aides he can only take Bill Clinton in limited doses, gave the former president and 15 others the Medal of Freedom at the White House. Here's President Obama honoring President Clinton.
I'm grateful, Bill, as well, for the advice and counsel that you've offered me on and off the golf course. And most importantly, for your life-saving work around the world, which represents what's the very best in America. So thank you so much, President Clinton.
You can join us in this hour. What do you think of the government's $13 billion settlement with J.P. Morgan, of the Cheney sisters' spat over gay marriage? Did you survive the Midwest's tornado alley this week? And what are you thinking this week about John F. Kennedy, his legacy that day, the day of the assassination? Bill McKenzie joins us from Dallas, Texas, today in the Dallas Morning News there. Trudy Rubin is with us from the Philadelphia Inquirer, and Jack Beatty is here. I want to turn to the big fine on J.P. Morgan, if we may, for a moment. Of course, all mixed up through its acquisitions in a lot of the trouble that led to the meltdown of the economy in 2008. On Wednesday, U.S. Attorney General Justice Department's lead negotiator Tony West told NPR that J.P. Morgan had's actions had led to serious national consequences.
The conduct J.P. Morgan has acknowledged, which is packaging risky home loans into securities, then selling them without disclosing their low quality to investors, that is behavior that we believe contributed to the wreckage of the financial crisis.
Bill McKenzie, $13 billion. It's the biggest settlement ever in history, a biggest payout by a corporation. Of course, about half of it tax deductible, which sticks in some people's craw. Nevertheless, it's big.
Yep.
Big enough, too little, too late, still a message anyway. What do you think, Bill?
Well, if I were J.P. Morgan, I think $13 billion is pretty big.
Half of their profit this year. That leaves a little bit on the table, though, I'd say.
Right. But, no, I think what the Justice Department was doing was right. They're sending a signal of whether it's $13 billion, it should be $13 billion or more. You know, I think they have a formula. They're kind of going and making some of this determination. But the point is, they were trying to send a signal, and it's an important signal. And it's an important signal to financial institutions. Hopefully they will carry forward in the future. Hopefully we don't have a situation like this again. But the signal is that they were part of the problem, part of the reason we got in the problem, and you're going to pay a price. And I don't have a problem with that.
Jack, what do you think of the scale of that price, the timing of that price, the overall message here?
Well, the overall message should get their attention, but people, you know, who want more say, wait a minute, to really get their attention, you have to have criminal prosecutions or even convictions. But
Or at least names. Nobody is named here, just positions.
Yes. It says positions, executive vice president, and so on. And, you know, credit where credit is due, thanks to Elizabeth Warren, the new senator from Massachusetts, the U.S. attorney, Mary Jo White, in New York, has made that a condition of this settlement, from what I've read, that they could not, that the Justice Department would not say, nope, that precludes any criminal prosecution. They didn't agree with that. That's still out there as a threat. And so long as it is, I think that acts as a deterrent. On the other hand, it does sort of throw me for a loop when I see that the board is all behind Mr. Diamond, who's now cost them. Well, he was the man when this happened, and the reason is they regard this, quote, according to the New York Times, as a victory. Good Lord, maybe we all need to rethink what a defeat would look like.
Sam in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air.
My kudos to Mr. Diamond. I think he got an excellent settlement. You know, when I think back on what could have been done, I'm reminded, I don't know how many of you are old enough to remember Michael Milken, but he's the famous trader who, the federal government brought RICO charges against him. And that's what should have happened. These guys are racketeers. They are, there's no doubt that this was securities fraud. And so I think Diamond did an excellent job. I think the Attorney General took good care of him, and I think that there's absolutely no reason to put any faith in hope. Hope is not what stops criminals, you know, the mafia would keep doing what they're doing. So, you know, this is the price of doing business. And he made a dime and made a great investment and got a great deal on those companies.
Sam, we've got it. I appreciate your call. I mean, $13 billion, it sounds like a lot of money. It is a lot of money. On the other hand, think of all the suffering of these last years, people who lost their homes, people who paid their mortgage, but their whole neighborhood went to pot as others were lost and abandoned. That is a pile of suffering right there. I want to turn for a moment, if I may, to the Cheney sisters. Of course, we've got Liz Cheney running for Senate in Wyoming to the right of a sitting senator there. She came out on Fox News Sunday saying that she opposed same-sex marriage, even though her sister Mary is famously lesbian and married herself. She said it's just an area where we disagree, referring to her sister. Mary Cheney went on Facebook, blasted back. Liz, she wrote, this isn't just an issue on which we disagree. You're just wrong and on the wrong side of history. Trudy Rubin, this has got to be uncomfortable for any family. Here's a very public family where the former vice president himself has come out with some very tolerant, very open comments on gay marriage. Now sisters fighting in public. And once again, there's the social issue. Does Liz Cheney have to take this position in spite of her sister's circumstances because she's trying to get to the right of a sitting Republican?
Well, exactly. I think, as many people have said, Liz Cheney is showing a determined streak of opportunism. She came in as a carpetbagger to Wyoming, challenging a very popular sitting Republican senator, a conservative from the right, which upset a lot of folks in the state. So we don't know how that's going to turn out. And as her sister pointed out, when Mary Cheney was married, Liz was there, seemed very supportive. And now she talks condescendingly of having compassion for her sister. And interestingly, her father is now adopting that language of compassion, which again indicates that there was something wrong with the marriage.
Something close to pity, almost.
Condescend. Mm-hmm. Whereas before he was supporting gay marriage because of his daughter. So it seems that he, too, is willing to engage in this family tragic quarrel in order to support his daughter's run for the Senate from the right, again splitting the Republican Party. So I don't see it as much as a family quarrel as I do a great display of political opportunism.
Bill McKenzie, do we get beyond this issue? Gay marriage legal in a lot of states now, or does it sit out there for years, even as much of America comes to accept?
Well, I think it's going to sit out there for years as more states come to it. But I do think that the Cheney situation kind of points at what I think is the way we're going to finally get to a broader acceptance of gay marriage, which I support and hope we get there. And that is when it's families having to wrestle with this issue personally. If a family member is gay, then, you know, that's going to change perhaps the way some people look at this. Now, in the Cheney situation, there's a lot of politics, as Trudy pointed out, involved in this. But I think that dynamic is what's really going to change people's attitudes towards this when they realize, you know, this is my family member. How am I going to respond? This isn't just an other. This is right here in front of me. What do we do?
I want to turn to history that's very much on many people's minds today, not least, of course, Bill McKenzie, in your hometown there of Dallas, but the whole country and really the whole world. November 22nd, 1963. Anybody who was alive and old enough will never forget it. Here was Walter Cronkite of CBS announcing the president's death, John F. Kennedy, on the air.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago.
Bill McKenzie, this week has brought it all back for me. I was very young at the time, but nobody forgets it. I was maybe 7 or 8 years old. Vivid, vivid memories of that day and all that followed. You're in Dallas. What's the mood in Dallas this week? They had a cloud over the city for many years. Is it still there, Bill?
Right. No, it's a very real issue in Dallas where a ceremony, the city has planned a ceremony. In fact, as we speak, I'm looking out my window at the window from which Oswald shot Kennedy. So,
wow.
You know, it is a very visible reminder of what happened here. I will say to Dallas's credit, for the last year, led by Mayor Mike Rawlings, the city has held had a number of forums where all sorts of issues were brought out, from JFK's legacy to what the attitude was like here in Dallas at the time. Our newspaper has done countless articles on it. I've participated in a number of videos with recollections of people from that time. So I think, you know, the city has really tried to put it all out there to be discussed and be debated. Clearly, Dallas is a different place than it was in 1963. So many different layers and levels of society and people. And the percentage of people who are in Dallas today who were here back in 1963 is pretty slender.
On that day, if I've got it right, Lee Harvey Oswald's mother lived not far from the junior high school you were attending. You saw squad cars around her house. Didn't know why.
Right. Well, my mother did. I was in elementary school. She was taking my brother at junior high school. Mm-hmm. And, so she didn't know why the squad cars were there. Mrs. Oswald did live in the neighborhood, and later, I didn't know who she was before. I would see her in a neighborhood grocery store, and to put it perhaps most politely, she was a crank.
But right in the middle on that day. Yeah. Trudy Rubin, what was lost on that day?
You know, it's easy to look back now and say, you know, that America's innocence was lost. But I think that was the beginning of a process of America becoming a less optimistic and less naive in a positive way, believing in a promising future, believing that everyone could get ahead. It started then. I think the thing that strikes me most is that back then Americans didn't tend to believe in conspiracy theories. And I, at the time, as a young person, I couldn't believe that there was a deep conspiracy. It had to be this one man who shot the president. And of course, conspiracy theories evolved, but most Americans didn't accept them. Conspiracy theories thrive in the Middle East because nobody trusts anyone and nobody believes information. If, God forbid, a tragedy like this happened today, immediately people would hatch conspiracy theories because they no longer have, I think, the trusting nature, the sunny belief in the future that still existed in a hangover from the post-war era on the day that Kennedy was shot.
Jack, it was a terrible day. I mean, I've heard young people say, well, maybe it was like 9/11, reaching for something to compare. How do you see what was lost, shaken that day?
Well, I do think Trudy is right, that sort of national confidence in the buoyant moment of America, what someone would call the American high, that seemed to end there, at least symbolically. And you have this sort of blood-dimmed tide that just goes on from there. And the sense that, in some insane way, the rule of the people was replaced by the rule of the gun. And you know, in this fear-ridden, gun-toting nation, that still seems out there. At least in private life, the fear we all live in, now institutionalized, now part of the weekly news, now these, you know, periodic massacres reminding us of it. We're not protected against the lunatics, we're not protected against the haters, and we're not protected against the guns.
Bill McKenzie, in brief, what would you say to a 20-year-old listening today who wonders, what was that thing they're mourning the passage of on that day, beyond the man himself?
Well, I think Trudy put it well. I think we lost a lot of faith in our institutions that day, and it's taken us a long time to figure out some way to recover it. I don't think we'll ever be like we were on November 21st, 1963, but there was an idealism that was lost, and we have attempted to try to recover it over time, painful though it has been.
A sad, sad day, 50 years ago now. Wrenching to so many people I've heard, and remembering how they saw parents cry for the first time, figures of authority cry for the first time, grown people, adults all over the country, children weeping 50 years ago today as the news sunk in. Bill McKenzie with us today from Dallas, Texas. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Bill McKenzie, Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial columnist at the Dallas Morning News. Trudy Rubin with the Philadelphia Inquirer. Thank you, Trudy.
Great to be here. Thanks, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, thank you as always for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Here's a short clip from President John F. Kennedy, his inaugural address, an earlier, happier day, the youngest elected president in American history, January 20th, 1961.
In your hands, my fellow citizens, more than mine, will rest the final success or failure of our course. Since this country was founded, each generation of Americans has been summoned to give testimony to its national loyalty. The graves of young Americans who answered the call to service surround the globe. Now the trumpet summons us again, not as a call to bear arms, though arms we need, not as a call to battle, though in battle we are, but a call to bear the burden of a long twilight struggle, year in and year out, rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, a struggle against the common enemies of man, tyranny, poverty, disease, and war itself. Can we forge against these enemies a grand and global alliance? North and south, east and west, that can assure a more fruitful life for all mankind. Will you join in that historic effort?
The hopeful voice of President John F. Kennedy on his inauguration day, 1961, his assassination 50 years ago today, 1963. Thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.